Let me introduce myself briefly. My name is Subhash Katil. I'm from an organization called Drum, Desi's Rising Up and Moving, from New York City. A lot of people were in the last workshop, so forgive me. I just still have to introduce myself to other people that don't know who the hell I am. Our organization has been doing work for the past 2 years on immigrant detention in the United States, and what we tend to call the growth of immigrant apartheid in America. And you know, there's been a lot of common themes and a lot of common issues, and I guess where I'll start off is I'll just start talking about this term immigrant apartheid, like, more in detail, and, you know, the growth of immigrant apartheid more in detail as it applies to, you know, brothers and sisters in the South Asian community, the Arab community, the Muslim community that we've been working with, and other immigrant communities of color that we've been working with. It starts with a basic question: What is apartheid? You know, and everyone knows what apartheid was in South Africa. Everyone is, you know, seeing every day what, you know, how violent forms of apartheid play themselves out, you know, in Palestine right now. And basically, apartheid is something in which people can occupy different legal categories of human beings based on who they are. In a very basic way, is that you become legally different from other human beings because of who you are, because you happen to be black, or because you happen to be Palestinian, or because, in this case, you happen to be an immigrant. And that's what we're seeing the development of, not just in the United States, but in plenty of first world countries, where you're seeing the growth of institutions that are enforcing this form of apartheid on human beings based on immigration status. And I mean, For folks that were in the last workshop and for folks that weren't, you know, as we said, since September 11th, 1,200 to 2,000 people in Arab, South Asian, and Muslim communities have been detained, in addition to the 25,000 or so immigrants, mostly immigrants of color, that would be in INS detention, be detained by Immigration and Naturalization Service in America on any given day, and in line with the tens of thousands of people that are deported every year that were immigrants in America. Now, you know, we were visiting hundreds of brothers and sisters locked up. And the reality of it was they would not be there if they were citizens. So they would see sunlight if they were citizens. And, you know, they would be outside if they were citizens. And they'd be talking to the families if they were citizens. They wouldn't have to collect calls from jail if they were citizens in that brief period of time. That the whole process of dehumanization and criminalization happened because they were not citizens. And the way that plays itself out in the day-to-day life of immigrant communities of color in America and in other parts of the world is growing. Any walk into an immigration office in the United States, and what you come across metal detectors. You come across bulletproof glass protecting you from the person that's cursing you out and asking you why you can't speak English. As a working in the Immigration and Naturalization Service Office of the INS, of the Justice Department, walking into a social welfare office to try to get refugee benefits, and being confronted once again with bulletproof glass and with security guards and with metal detectors and with people asking you why you can't speak English and why did you come to this country and did you come here illegally and things like that. Basic trips to the library, basic trips to school where you're stopped and asked for your ID and actually immigration status by police, by men with guns and bulletproof vests and things like that. So the day-to-day life of immigrants of color, of third world peoples living in first world countries, becomes one where it's okay that they occupy different categories of human beings. This all becomes legal. As I said before, we had the 1996 laws, which allowed whole categories of human beings to be detained strictly because they were immigrants. And so, like I just said, this plays itself out in different areas of life. It plays itself out in terms of incarceration rates, in terms of the growth of incarceration rates in immigrant communities, and the growth of an INS presence in immigrant communities, and the growth of cooperation with the immigration police, with the Immigration and Naturalization Service, and the NYPD, and the New York City Police Department. Excuse me, I keep throwing out these acronyms as if everyone knows what they mean. But, you know, the growth of cooperation between the Immigration and Naturalization Service and the police department. And then in public education, for example, the growth of cooperation between immigration and the school board, between immigration and school officials and teachers, in social services and the growth of cooperation between immigration and the welfare office. And so you literally have, if you start drawing profiles of people and you start, you know, taking different stories of people, you have one human being who may be white, middle class, and citizen. And one person, and this is the example I put out the most to people, just to give you an idea of how different lives can be in a place like America in a system of apartheid and how we may not realize it. You go to the state of Texas, you take one human being who's middle class and white or upper middle class and white who gets caught drunk driving. Assuming he gets caught drunk driving. Assuming he drives his own car. And he gets caught drunk driving. He does two or three weeks in jail, 2 months in jail, whatever. After the time he does in jail, once again, assuming he does time in jail, he goes out and he gets to kiss his family and goes on to become president, right? Now, you have a similar situation in the state of Texas, right? Where you have a low-income person of color who's a non-citizen. Or let's not even go that far. He's a legal permanent resident. He has a green card. You know, he's a legal immigrant who gets caught drunk driving, right? And does more than 2 weeks in jail. Let's say he does a whole month in jail. Well, in the state of Texas, that's a deportable offense. So after a month in jail, he goes to jail again, this time because he's not a citizen. If he decides to fight his immigration case, he can spend as much as 2 months, 3 months, sometimes a year, sometimes 2 years. If he happens to be Palestinian or Libyan and, you know, Israel or Libya won't take him back, he could be in there indefinitely for drunk driving in the state of Texas. And there's another guy that got to go out and kiss his family and become president in the same state. They could have lived a half mile apart from each other. So we all know now there's a form of immigrant apartheid in America. And this is part of a system of apartheid that's always operating in the global context. If you deal with colonialism, the history of colonialism, the history of racism, capitalism, patriarchy, basically where you had a history in which a bunch of people from a place called Europe left Europe, either they left Europe or they sent another group of people to go leave Europe and go take a bunch of money, a bunch of other stuff from another group of people in other parts of the world, in India, in Africa, in the Caribbean, right? And so when colonialism was over and when people effectively kicked these same groups of people out of their countries, they still stayed in the form of the World Bank, in the form of the IMF, in the form of military bases, whatnot. And you see this huge concentration of wealth forming that spreads from the third world to the first world, or if you live within the first world, from third world communities to first world communities in America, in Canada, in Europe. And then you see people's reaction to it. In third world countries, you see people acting upon the situation of economic violence and political violence and acting upon the fact that while you have wealth flowing from third world countries to first world countries, from poor countries to rich countries, from poor people to rich people, you have poverty flowing to third world countries. You have violence flowing to third world countries. Why? Because, you know, guns are part of free, you know, are part of free trade, and, you know, and military aid to states that are violent is part of free trade. So when groups of people decide to act upon that and leave, and act upon that and go to countries that it took from them and actively take back. The reason I stated like this is I stated in terms of reparations, and I stated in terms of what is owed to third world peoples, given the process of colonialism, given the process of racism, and given the global roots of why immigration takes place, right? When people go to take back or to leave situations of violence, whether it be political or economic, that were created, that have their roots in first world power, they're confronted with apartheid once again. They're confronted with detention. They're confronted with jail. They're confronted with officers asking for your papers. They're confronted with the inability to go to college in some cases. They're confronted with the inability to get social services, right? But then there's this other need. There's this need of people in the first world for cheap labor in any way, shape, or form that it comes about, whether it's in sweatshops in the third world or whether it's sweatshops filled with third world people in the first world. It you know, plays out in all sorts of different types of ways, right? So you have this situation, and then in this situation, we go back to the reason of why does detention happen. And I liked what you said before about detention does not happen, and this is something we keep stating over and over again because people always ask us, why do you think they want to get rid of all the immigrants? Well, the reality of it is first world countries cannot get rid of all the immigrants, because what happens if you get rid of all the immigrants? You don't have people to do low-wage labor for you. Your economies fall apart. You need people. You need these immigrants to do this labor. You need immigrants to fill these positions. But you don't need them to organize. You don't need them to take back power. You don't need them to assert their own humanity. And so then we go into the reasons for detention being social control. And once again, this is where before we've traditionally drawn from the reasons prisons exist in the first world and to the reasons detention exists in the first world, and drawing the parallels between the war on drugs being something that put 2 million people of color in prison, took the right to vote away from millions of people, put whole communities in jail in situations where they were doing cheap labor and free labor in jails, and also to whole communities that were devastated, the whole communities that were initially organizing and mobilizing for their own liberation and then were then put in jail. And then we go into the situation with immigration and the historical roots of immigration. If you look at the roots as to why detention happens, right, and why detention has traditionally happened, you go back to not just the Patriot Act, not just the 1996 immigration laws, you go all the way back to the Alien and Sedition Acts and people that were traditionally detained. People that were traditionally detained, not only did they come from communities that they wanted to silence, they came from communities that they thought were potentially dangerous. They came from communities that were in the process of organizing. So if you look at the Black Liberation Movement, you look at what the Immigration Naturalization Service's effect on the Black Liberation Movement was, people like Marcus Garvey were actively deported. If you look at the labor movement, people like Emma Goldman were deported. Half the labor movement in New York City's leadership that was often Eastern European immigrants was actively deported. You actively had voices of dissent that were removed from the country, voices of dissent that were completely disappeared from the country, right? And I'm sorry, my brain's a little scattered. So you have the use of detention, you have the use of prison, you have the use of institutions of apartheid to strike fear into communities, to change their day-to-day lives, to where it's legally okay to silence them, it's legally okay to treat them as effective non-human beings, right? And so then this becomes a question to everyone and a question to think about. And in terms of what we were talking about before, in terms of looking at the brothers and sisters that we work with in our communities, looking at the people that were disappeared, and another point that was brought up, people have talked about the Arabs, Muslims, and South Asians that were disappeared as objects. At the very least, when you look at publicly how they're talked about in the media, you have this whole group of people that talks about them as suspected terrorists and as criminals and as people that are illegal that shouldn't be here. But at the very best, you start the media and the public talk about them as objects, as victims, as poor immigrants that were working so hard here, right? And that's like the very best image that you get, you know, from the media, right? To me, this asks a question. Things like the Patriot Act, things like the 1996 immigration laws, were they preemptive, and were they there to kill a movement? I think I know the answer to that question. And the reason I ask that question is, everything that's lined out in terms of the Patriot Act, everything that's spelled out in terms of the 1996 immigration laws, even existed before the 1996 immigration laws. In 1987, you have a document put out by the Justice Department called an anti-terrorism contingency plan. Now, this document's really important because this document's actually been used in courts of law to argue that what happened to brothers and sisters in the Arab, South Asian, and Muslim community amounted to racial profiling. You have a document put out by the Justice Department talking about a contingency plan in the event of a terrorist attack. And the contingency plan in the event of a terrorist attack looks remarkably similar to what we've seen go on. They're breaking down on people's doors at 6 o'clock in the morning, handcuffing them in front of their kids, putting them in jail, you know, forcing the active deportation of people from very specific communities. Even gets into numbers. So was this preemptive? And when I ask questions like, was the Patriot Act preemptive? Let's look up at the group of folks that was detained by the INS after September 11th and who they are, who they were, who they could be, and the categories that they occupied in terms of who they were and where they came from in American society. Low income and working class, low income working class and Muslim, low income working class Muslim, people of color, people from third world communities, low income working class Muslim, people of color, third world immigrants. Let's look at different issues. Let's look at poverty. Let's look at the war that was going on, the war against terrorism, both abroad and at home. Let's look at racism. Let's look at globalization. And let's look at the repression of immigrants. And let's look at how important these groups, this group of people that have disappeared are and who they are and who they could be. And one of the things I think is what we're dealing with is that in this point in time, in this period in time, we're dealing with what is and could become the most potentially radical voices. We're dealing with families whose backs were against the wall, who are actively speaking out against the INS, and at the same time were actively speaking out against the war, and could actively be speaking out against immigration policy. And so these aren't objects, and these aren't victims, and these aren't people to pity, and these aren't characters to write stories about. These are groups of people from our communities that were finding every way, shape, and form that they could to speak out, and looking for ways to express their voices whenever possible, whether it was through the use of hunger strikes, whether it was through the use of rallies, or whether it was just the ability to walk down the street to the masjid. In some days was a radical act and was a revolutionary act after September 11th in New York City. We saw communities that were there trying to find outlets and trying to find openings to express their rage at what was going on. And this is where it becomes important. This is where the disappeared become important. And this is where we have to stop looking at them as objects and as victims and start looking at our brothers and sisters that were detained by the INS and that are actively deported and their families as the, in this day and time, groups of people that in many ways were intuitively anti-war, intuitively against the immigration policies, intuitively against detention because their family members and loved ones were there, and intuitively had the desire to work against this. And, you know, there's cases like, you know, the detention of our brother Farouk Abdulmuti that were really exemplary of this, a brother who's a Palestinian activist who also had immigration issues that was detained by the INS 2 weeks ago and is still in detention, who has a son that, you know, we've been working with in a campaign to free him. But also looking at it in terms of the day-to-day lives of people in the community. People like Usman Naheed, whose husband and brother were both detained, who shortly after the detention would go everywhere speaking out against detention and speaking out against the injustice being perpetrated on her and her family by the Justice Department. You know, everyday voices of people in our community. You know, and the rallies that were being organized were more and more being occupied, the people that were participating in these rallies were more and more people from communities, from directly affected communities. I wanted to stop there and just leave that thought with people about why the work that's going on now, why grassroots work that's going on now in directly affected communities is so important, and why that work needs to be facilitated and supported in every way, shape, or form possible. Because it's not because we're helping so many people, or it's not because we're doing this, it's not because we're fixing objects. It's because the brothers and sisters in our community that are directly affected now are some of the most potentially radical voices. So I just wanted to leave it there.